listening to Atoms, Motion, and the Void on 90.5 WSPS Concord Community Radio. If you're interested in listening at home on your PC, iPhone, or BlackBerry, where this station streams live on the internet, please visit www.wsps.sps.edu or visit my website at radioghost.com for the link. Violet sparkles in the after-storm sky and the smell of wood smoke. It was bitterly cold and almost 10 o'clock, and I was standing in the ice shadows between two very tall, very thin pines in the Gresham Park, directly across from the Pontiac Vindago Theatre. Except for the white tea kettling of my breath, I was camouflaged in my black Hanalikin. I had not slept in more than 36 hours, nor eaten much, and, to Tristram Battlebane's mandate of silence, I had not spoken in quite some time. All this, in conjunction with my new smoking habit, had conspired into a late afternoon sick. But, after vomiting into the basin, I felt better than I had in quite some time. Lighter, clearer, unencumbered, complete despite all my lacks. There was another feeling, too, which had taken leave of my body. A type of crankiness or crossness, of a perpetual sense that the world was not understanding me rightly, and thereby doing me some harm. This created an ongoing distrust of every moment, of all encounters. But now I was free of that. Walking away from my stomach emptying, I was easy on my feet, and my face felt soft and flush and warmly unexpressive. I was neither wary nor weary, but indolent and calm. Though it was late October, it felt as though winter's blitzkrieg had already fully arrived, and yet for just this evening had lifted its dressing gown back into the sky, leaving only a dazzled, frigid pavement. There was a sense of crystals in the air and disappearing diamonds, and of a hard thing smacked and left to its stunning. But the magically thin stalwart garb was keeping me warm. My fingers in the gloves and my head within the mask were warm and dry. I was keeping my eye pinned on the alley side rear door of the theater, where, in a few moments, my impostor would step forward and begin his 9-block trek home. I wasn't sure yet how I would refer to my replacement in my mind, if at all, but the longer I waited for him, the more it seemed right that I simply think of him as Show and Sleeves. The marquee of the Pontiac Vindago brightly blared its nightly offer, Arthur Battlebane's Mistrigial, and down near the bottom, in small, crooked letters, a token gesture to its star, with S. Sleeves. The heavy glass front doors of the theatre were finally swung wide by two men who looked like undertakers in their extra similar shiny shoes and black suits and cloaks. At first I only heard the echoey splash of voices, and then watched as the crowd of 100 or so made their streaming exit. The women and men in their theatre clothes in this postpartum moment seemed invigorated and charged, as though the performance they had just witnessed had done its job and altered them ever so slightly to the good. They had been widened, deepened, revived. They took enjoyment in the surprising harshness of the weather, laughter as coats were buttoned up to the chin, pleasure taken with the extra tucking down to hand cup a match and light a cigarette out of the wind. This was a coldness they would remember, following an evening of enrichment Having such a memory, even being still within the foundry of the moment's making, the unique disposition of an event as it rolled beneath their feet, was good. This was how it should be. Lightness and laughter as they dispersed, fresh born almost, freshly alive, certainly. My eye returned to the alley door. I imagined that Sherwin was now changing into his street clothes. I wondered if he'd gone so far as to venture into my wardrobe. How complete an affair would this be? Would he wear my things? My shoes? My rotten socks? It was easy for me. I was stepping up several class levels into a soothing roost I had never known or expected. But he was now the caretaker of my discomforts, the keeper of my cold things. About 10 yards to my left, I noted an unexpected white jet of smoke. It seemed to pipe forward with regularity from the dark and slick trunk of one of the Gresham Park oaks. For whatever reason, I made no inquiry into this. It was anomalous, but yet I had no curiosity about it. I noted it, but put no resource into generating any accounting theory. Later, I would realize that Mr. Cassidy had been watching me, even then. Final stragglers emerged, boozy on their feet and a little extra merry as the undertakers drew the sanctum to a close. In the theater interior, while the concierge threaded chains around the doors, the theater lights popped slowly off. When the marquee sign finally itself rattled off, a distinctly clean silence extended. As with so much of the sensory world, I had not fully noticed the electric humming of the sign until it was gone. The opened world of night silence I depreciated on the balcony of my new apartment once again returned to me. A dog barked. A man shouted. Something fell. With the lights off and the theater closed, I felt a drop in temperature, as though my eyes had feasted on the light and life of the place. Even at 50 yards, I believe I heard the little shrill grind of the doorknob as it turned. The alley door opened, and Sherwin's sleeves stepped forth. He was not smiling, as I was, at the intrepid foolishness of this jaunty, highbrow game. I could not rescind my grin, which had spread to my eyes and cheeks. All were peeled back in happiness at the absurdity of my being him, and him being me. Already wearing my ear-flap fedora, Sherwin pulled on shabby brown gloves, my own, I was pleased to see, and then he wrapped my Berliner long coat over his shoulders, slipped his gloved hands into his pockets, and straightened after my manner, and with a little effort, as though these first steps he was overly conscious of the form he was trying to mimic, and of my scrutiny of it, he began to walk down 4th Street. Gresham Park happily continued westerly several blocks, and provided a very easy initial observation. I was stepping along a grass path, keeping with Sherwin's steady pace, doing my best to walk in Arthur's hunched-over Hasidic manner, a way of moving that I first assumed related to some pride or philosopher's vanity, as though he must look always to be perpetually involved in the deepest excavations of his artistry. But now I understood it had all to do with his disintegrating vertebrae. He hunched because he had to. As I further considered the matter of his affliction-generated posture, I understood that his provocative straightening, imitating me, was probably doing him some damage. Sherwin stopped, unexpectedly, as I'm sure I would not have, at a glassy storefront. He raised a glove to block the street lamp glare and peered in. A jewelry store. I had never noted it. I wondered why he would, at such an early moment, break character simply to observe some expensive bauble now surely out of his fiscal reach. And I was about to call out, "Arthur, what in the world are you doing?" When I remembered that there was a little Christmas village I'd taken to looking at after the show, somewhere along the way and coming out of nowhere and attached to nothing. In the all but darkened window, a small bulb over a poignant scene, a snow-covered mountain, fronted by a merry little village with a road full of old-fashioned metal cars, painted yellow and red, and a big skating pond with a few skylarking figures with long scarves pressed out into the wind. The centerpiece was a dwarf Christmas tree with a toppled clutter of wrapped boxes, and then a single open present within which, pinched in velvet, shone a beautiful and enormous diamond ring. I had never widened my taking in of this curious tableau. It existed in a vacuum and had not made any formal connection to the jewelry shop or the street itself, but simply floated in me like a pure daydream. I realized that I had all but failed to remember the experience. Several minutes passed. I was shocked that Sherwin was spending so extended a period enchanting himself on the glorious model village. I refused at least to acknowledge this aspect. If it was true that I glanced in at the illuminated Christmas village, I was firm in my belief that it was a casual encounter. It was not the momentous event as Beryl Bane was trying to make out with his longanimity. Finally, he raised his gloved hand and began to pat at the window pane. My face screwed up as to the meaning of this. I was no window patter. But then, as he turned, I heard a faint tune rising on the air and saw his mouth moving lightly. Sherwin was singing, something I knew for certain I did not do, at least not in public. Obviously, behind closed doors, I might hum out a snatch of this, but I was too private and on guard to be so informal in the public garden, as it were. But once more, as the song left its imprint and the melody carried through me, I found myself entering a type of dark fuselage of forgetfulness. I found that I did, after all, recognize the peculiar song, that the Christmas scene in the jewelry store window had jogged a memory of a Russian lullaby I had not heard in quite some time. As sure of myself that I had not sung the lullaby out loud, yet the obviousness of my error glared. If I had not sung it out loud, how had Beryl Bane learned of it? I had first heard the lullaby called Nina Nonna when I was a boy of 8 or 9. A large extended family of Russians had moved in up the street, and one Christmas evening, as I lay listening on the floor to one of my radio shows, I had glanced up and seen an old woman in a red hat and red scarf, smiling with drunken brightness on our porch, gently tapping at the living room window. This was one of the old Russian grandmothers from up the street. In a trance, I was drawn toward her and stood in a daze as she sang to me through the glass. My parents had been shortly expecting carolers, and, hearing her voice, had come curiously in. Witnessing her inappropriate caroling, my father stormed to the window, pounded it awfully, and shooed her away. I didn't hear the song for another 20 years, but when I did, I took my time to bring its heart and general figure into my little repertoire of important things that needed keeping. We were walking now, Sherwin still singing, and as though in some dancing response, a request to the universe, a new fresh snow began to fall. And then again, as though in response to both of these, in the quietness beneath my Hanalikan, I found that I was singing it too.
Fai la nanna, pupo bello della mamma, ninna oh, ninna oh. Lo daremo alla befana che lo tenghi una settimana, lo daremo all'uomo nero che lo tenghi anno intero, ninna oh, ninna oh. Fai la ninna, fai la nanna, pupo bello della mamma, lo daremo alla befana, che pazienza ci vuoi, ninna oh, ninna oh.
As Sherwin turned right down Hollowing Avenue, I had to exit Gresham Park and cross over 4th Street. to maintain some comfortable distance from him and to keep more within the shadows. I headed for the opposite and unlit sidewalk and trailed back. Sherwin continued on about 20 yards in front of me on the far side of the street. Hollowing becomes increasingly residential and impoverished as you move further south, and I watched now as Sherwin began his voyeuristic glancings, nosing a little too doggishly here and there, deeply and directly into any first floor window with a light on. I felt comfortably sure that I did such looking irregularly and only if reasonably drawn by some visible commotion. Sherwin stopped before a residence with a particularly bright first-floor window. I saw the number, 183, on the exterior mantel above the door. I remembered this. I could admit looking forward to my observation of the festivities at 183. There was a young, libertarian couple who lived here, in a state of too much heat. Either that, or someone had stolen their clothing. But they did, both of them, wander around quite undressed, and with very dramatic movement. They were always chasing each other, or dancing, or jumping. I had no idea what they were doing, but I rationalized my brief investigations as being my formal consent to their larger, informal invitation. I felt sure that they not only enjoyed being observed, but that further, if they knew I was there, they would encourage it. Dancing and racing around unclothed at night, in bright rooms with the shades drawn, on a first-floor apartment, seemed all the evidence one needed to take a guiltless gander. I had, once or twice, even imagined that the young free thinkers would invite me in, and I would sit in a corner with a cup of scotch and enjoy their liberty. It wasn't exactly their nakedness which excited me, but their pleasure in the indiscretion, or in the pleasure or relief of dissolving the sense of shame and violation that attended transgression. Sherwin removed something from his jacket, and I blushed, remembering that I kept what looked like a pen in my coat pocket, but was really a small child's telescope. Sherwin lifted the glass to his eye and peered with such obvious directness and leaned with such grotesquerie into the little garden fence that I again was almost forced to call out to him the ineptness of his performance. "I don't do that," I wished to shout with righteous indignity. This was abuse of a very subtle kind, I felt, as though one were imitating a very pretty and vain young woman, and, in the performance, simply stood before a mirror and preened and sighed with delight at one's own beauty. Maybe there was truth in the fact of the preening, but there could be punishment in the exaggerated imitation, and the lack of subtlety here, I thought, permitted cancellation of any correlative truth. Thus I felt I could, without dishonor, claim that what I was witnessing, aside from the basic truth of the fact that I did sometimes look into windows, and yes, with the small pocket scope, that it was not me. This was not how Sherwin-Sleeves behaved. I was not an ugly voyeur. I was a gentle and casual one, and there was a world of difference in the two. As the ridiculous Peeping Tom show continued, I found myself stepping down off the sidewalk. My face was reddening. If he was going to be me, he could not be allowed to so disgrace my actuality. As I began to cross toward him, he lifted a leg over the waist-high fence and climbed into the small yard. I looked nervously down the street, begging for emptiness, as I found myself worried that I might be caught. Sherwin pushed now into the bushes, and, awful memory, I recalled the presence of a small, already set-up stepladder hidden back in the hedge. Sherwin mounted this, and like a child at a candy store, placed his face against the rosy glow of the window. "Sir," a voice in the darkness behind me called. "Sir, I'll ask you to stop there if you don't mind." I turned and stepped back up the curb, to one side of a low stoop in the little front yard of a sleeping stone residence. I saw a shadowy figure. Smoke jetted from his darkened face. His outline was odd and blurred with the background blackness to such an extent that I was not actually sure he was real. "Someone there," I said. "You're not to have contact with Mr. Sherwin," the voice said. "No," I said, "I wasn't." "You were, sir, I saw you. But that's why I'm here, isn't it?" he said. I again stared deeply toward the figure. "It's only," I began. "You see, he's not doing me right. He's got you to a T, sir, the voice said. I took a few steps closer to the stranger, but found him no clearer in my view than before. He fidgeted under his outfit and withdrew a small notebook. October 24, Christmas window, 4 minutes. Starts singing. Stops next at 183, hollowing. Watches for 3 minutes with pocket telescope. Then up the ladder and watches through the window for 10 minutes. He clapped the book shut and hid it back into his clothing. Of course, I said. I may once have. Every night exactly the same, sir, like clockwork. To the second, even, most nights. To the second, I said. Oh, look, he's off. You best follow. And remember, keep your distance, Mr. Barrelbane. Of course, I said. I was perhaps only a foot or so from him, but still, he remained hardly discernible in the chiaroscuro of the garden darkness. You're a stalwart, I suddenly stumbled to the obvious fact. Name's Cassidy, the voice said. A car was grilling up through the thickening snow toward us. I watched its lights beam along the buildings, and I turned and reached to shake his hand. But Cassidy was gone.
Remember.
I was shaken. Another half block further, the dark warehouse rectangle of the William Pines rooming house loomed. Sherwin seemed oblivious to his recent experience at the window, as though it were nothing remarkable. But somehow, observing him made room for a perspective of his person that I had never had. His identity, my identity, the strength of my belief in my own self-knowing, had been delicately shattered. If the world was a disaster, I had always felt that at least I knew who I was, that I was this way and that way, the captain of my own sinking ship, a respectable, intellectual, artistic gentleman, above average in all ways, and careful of and polite to his fellow men. Perhaps a little bitter, but existentially so, with well-fathomed reason to be displeased, having fully, as deeply as could be done, investigated the world and found it rotten. I had retreated into a dignified and princely suffering. But this was not the person I saw. From my observer's post in just a short 20 minutes, I had seen another entity entirely. The Sherwin sleeves I had so ardently imagined myself to be did not exist. That what I held in my mind was simply a kind of coldly self-loving portrait, an allied contraption of truth and lies. I was this and I was that, some of it marginally correct, most of it as make-believe as any former stage character I had played. This struck me dumb, that I could be so mistaken about the basic root of myself. Sherwin arrived at the William Pines, strode up the brick stairs, kicked around, as I assumed I must, in the dark corners on either side of the door for uncollected copies of the evening paper, and then went inside. A few moments later, I followed. As promised, both the main door and his apartment door remained open for my entry. Once inside the apartment, I simply stood on the far side of the door and allowed the small room to glisten in front of me like a mirage or a film. Sherwin sat in the kitchen shadows at the table, nursing together his nightcap. He had not turned on a single light. He had not taken off his hat or coat. He lifted the cheap volunteer whiskey I bought at the corner store and poured a small glass. He quickly tossed this back, and then poured another, and then stood and took the bottle and glass to the larger window in the sitting room. As he walked toward the chair, I moved in silently and took a seat in the shadows behind him. With the falling snow, there was no moonlight, but the city glare reflected down from the gray clouds, and I could observe his profile. He poured another glass and downed it, and then poured another and set the whiskey on the window shelf. Then he leaned toward the window and looked out over the city silhouette at the falling snow. He shuffled the chair closer to the window and glowered at the street below. He was sipping now, directly from the bottle, small, thoughtless tugs, and the bright, oily smell of the cheap whiskey began its quarrel with the air. I don't know how long he sat. I was in a state of thrall, in a state of quiescent, submissive oblivion. Only two nights before, this had been me. "Show inside. It's awful," he said. "Not good." I was shocked by his voice. My voice. He repeated this several times before standing with a groan. In a corner nook in the kitchen, he took off his jacket, gloves, and hat, and set them in their places. And then he walked back into the sitting room, stroking his hair with some kind of lost train of thought, sat down on the bed, kicked off his shoes, and lay down for sleep. I moved closer. He pulled the sheets to his chin, and a moment later in the cold room, began to shiver. There was a larger blanket in the closet, I knew, but I did not want to disrupt the order of the closet and then have to fold it up in the morning to regain the Spartan feel that so comforted me. If it got very cold, I would allow its use, but otherwise it was inefficient. I will not describe my feelings as, for the next long while, I watched Sherwin shiver and sigh and mutter to himself the same unpleasant, sad little phrases over and over again. "It's awful. Cold. Not good." It was all I could do to stop myself from reaching out to take his hand, to comfort him, to whisper, "It's all right. It's all right. It's going to be fine. Let me just fetch the blanket from the closet. No need to worry about folding it in the morning. Just keep it on the bed." I was closer and closer, hovering toward him, when a hand touched my shoulder and the faintest whisper came to my ear. "That's close enough, sir." And Cassidy's hand lightly pulled at my shoulder. And I realized with his touch, by its mothering pressure, even against the torture of my feelings, as I bore witness to the broken man on the bed, that, subtracting it all, in the furthest background of this sorrow, I was consoled.
"Treated you like a rusty blade, a throwaway from an open grave. Cut you loose from a chain gang and let you go. And on the day you said it's true, some love holds, some gets used. Tried to tell you I never knew it could be so sweet. Who could ever be so cruel? Blame the devil for the things you do. It's such a selfish way to lose, the way you lose these wasted blues, these wasted blues. Tell me that it's nobody's fault, nobody's fault but my own. Tell me that it's nobody's fault, nobody's fault but my own. Tell me that it's nobody's fault, nobody's fault but my own. Tell me that it's nobody's fault, nobody's fault but my own. When the moon is a counterfeit, better find the one that fits. Better find the one that lights the way for you. When the road is Clouds are full of heartless tales that drain on you. Who would ever notice you and fade into a shaded room? It's such a selfish way to lose, the way you lose these wasted blues, these wasted blues. Tell me that it's nobody's fault, nobody's fault but my own. Tell me that it's nobody's fault, nobody's fault but my own. Tell me that it's nobody's fault, nobody's fault but my own. Tell me that it's nobody's fault, nobody's fault but my own.
Listening to Atoms, Motion, and the Void on 90.5 WSPS Concord Community Radio. For more information on the show and the songs, please visit my website at radioghost.com. I'm Sherwin Sleeves. Tune in next Friday at 5 p.m. for more stories and music. Thank you, my friends.